It's time for Taking Care of Business on Midlands 103. With thanks to the local enterprise offices of Leash, Offaly and Westmeath. Find us on localenterprise.ie and let's talk business.
Midlands 103.
Hello and a very good evening to you. It's Tuesday the 24th of January. I'm Ronan Berry and you're very welcome to Taking Care of Business here on Midlands 103. Coming up on the show this evening, reaction from Leash Chamber as yet another small Leash business closes its doors. Mullingar headquartered engineering consultancy ORS have announced that Erisbeg Private Equity has taken a majority stake in their business. MD of ORS John Brennan and private equity partner at Erisbeg Andrew Murphy will discuss the deal and how it paves the way for strategic growth for the firm. Also, Breda Dooley from Matrix Recruitment will discuss a recent survey they carried out that suggests that the majority of workers in the country say that they have experienced discrimination in some form at work. Some really interesting statistics on that, and certainly an eye-opener in terms of what we all need to be looking out for in the businesses that we work in. If you want to join the conversation and get involved in this evening's show, you can text or WhatsApp me on 083 3010 103. That, of course, is powered by the home of Offaly's top-selling car brand, Lambrothers Toyota, on the Arden Road in Tullamore. But to begin this evening, I'm going to shift my focus onto eggs and not those chocolatey ones that, for some bizarre reason, are already beginning to appear in supermarkets around the country. I'm talking about the good old-fashioned, the traditional egg, the boiled egg that you might have, the scrambled egg, the egg you use when you're baking, are in numerous dishes. We just kind of take it for granted. We always assume that there will always be eggs, we'll always have availability of them, but yet it's another product that is coming under huge pressure from practice supply chains for many, many reasons. And before Christmas, a friend of mine owns a butcher shop and he kind of marked my card on this. He said that their suppliers were beginning to tell them that, you know, eggs and the supply of eggs could be under huge pressure in 2023. And then another person I know in the hotel sector told me how recently they got a letter from their supplier with a price increase that would absolutely knock you over. It was in the region of about 70% of a price increase on the basic price of eggs. So to find out more about maybe what's going on and where this might lead and what is driving this situation, I'm delighted to be joined by Barry Murphy. And Barry is a news reporter at the Irish Farmers Journal. Barry, what do we know about these rising egg prices and indeed what is causing it?
Well, thanks for having me on, Ronan. I suppose we know a lot. We have a clear picture of things at the moment. And just for listeners to be, I suppose, to explain the egg supply chain in Ireland and elsewhere, you know, it's made up of your retailers or your wholesalers and your egg packer really as the middleman and then your egg producers. So I suppose it's not those price increases you mentioned, you know, may not be coming from the farmer directly. They're probably coming from the egg packer, the middleman. On the shop shelf at the moment, what we're seeing is that egg prices have gone up in the region of about 72 cents in the last year for a dozen eggs. But the farmer is only getting about 10.5 to 12.5 cents of that increase. So as you can see, there's an egg price increasing passed back, but it's not getting all the way to the farmer. And what it's really leading to is, a cost squeeze for farmers at present. They're dealing with in a situation where, you know, they're not getting that price back, but they're also getting all inputs pushed up from further down in the supply chain. So, like everything, the cost of electricity has gone up, the cost of feed and so on, up about 40% for egg producers in the last year. I was talking to one farmer recently enough who's had his electricity costs have tripled in the last year, adding a 4,000 euro bill onto his production cost. So, really, they're in a cost squeeze at the moment. And what's happening is there's less eggs being produced because in European countries elsewhere and further afield, there's a number of factors really impacting supply, the main one being bird flu at the moment. We're seeing, say, in Croatia, for example, early January, the first few days of the year, we had a flock of 750,000 laying hens wiped out due to bird flu all from the one farm. And they made up about 15% of the country's total egg production, 600,000 eggs a day. And across the water in the US, you're seeing 58 million birds culled in the last year because of bird flu, leading to a 3% drop in egg prices, in egg supply, and leading to a 250% increase in price for eggs on the shop shelf. So in the region of, I think, the January 2021 price for a dozen eggs in the US was about 158, and that's gone up to 390 today. So it's not just a problem specific to Ireland. it's having kind of a ripple effect across the world.
And is Ireland self-sufficient in terms of egg supply, or do we rely on European sources to supply eggs to our market?
No, Ireland is self-sufficient, and we do import eggs as well. I suppose what Ireland has had in the last couple of weeks and months is we've fared reasonably well in terms of bird flu, despite maybe a few scares early on in the winter with a number of turkey flocks. For the most part, we have come out, you know, it's still touch wood, but we've come out better off than other countries, particularly our nearest neighbour in the UK. So that obviously puts us in a position where we can, you know, we can continue to export eggs. But that doesn't mean we haven't got away from this kind of cost squeeze hitting farmers at present. It's really putting them in a situation where they're really looking at the margins and they're, you know, they're not even breaking even at this point.
And even before the threat of avian flu really took hold, like our survey by the Irish Farmers Association back in September last year indicated about 80% of egg producers in this country indicated that they would not recommend future generations to continue in egg production. So a sector, dare I say, that's facing its challenges, never mind the mounting operational costs.
That's it, exactly, facing its challenges. And again, just to maybe inform listeners of other kind of IFA data, look, we're talking about egg prices going up on the shop shelf, but the reality is, I just checked there today, Tesco, you can get a dozen eggs for, or a half dozen eggs, apologies, for £2.25. That price in 2012 was £2.19, so that's only 6 cents more. So, you know, when you think about inflation and how everything else has gone up, you know, in those 10 odd years, you know, eggs haven't really gone up that much. And it goes back again. Farmers really got kind of, I suppose, frustrated back in September and October last year. Last few days of September, the first week of October, you might remember there was protests in Cavan Town at Lidl and Aldi in Cavan Town, where farmers were seeking a 2 cent per egg price increase or 24 cent per dozen. That led to one of the longest blockades in recent history in terms of farmer protests, and it led to the Aldi and the Lidl, the shop shelves emptied essentially of all kind of perishable goods. And the farmers' slogan at that time was, you know, no farmer, no food. And that's exactly what it led to. And those blockades were stood down after Aldi came forward with a 3 cent per egg price increase, or 36 cents per dozen. That was then passed back to the egg packer, and the farmers were supposed to get about a 1.2 cent per egg increase. Now, look, it's such small money when you think about it. And I'm sure any listener, any consumer would say that, you know, the boiled egg they had for breakfast there, of course, they wouldn't mind paying 1.2 cent more for it. And then they'd pay more for it again. But that's kind of the really kind of tight margins farmers are working off, and they're having to go to retailers in these kind of protests and really push. I do think it's quite Irish at the moment. You know, retailers market Irish produced eggs with the pictures of the farmer and the chickens in the supermarkets on the shop shelves and that kind of thing. And it's that very farmer that they're marketing kind of the egg off that is really struggling at the moment.
And is there anything to be done? Like, is there any intervention that might be made, you know, from a government level to support what is really a crucial sector?
That's it. Well, look, what's happening at the moment is the government is bringing in an agri-food regulator. Now, it was promised by Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConlogue, by the end of last year, and it isn't operational just yet. But I understand that they're recruiting the CEO for that post at the moment, and that recruitment process is near a finalisation. It'll be an office independent of the Department of Agriculture that will investigate complaints made on essentially what are unfair trading practices, you know, from a farm organisation, for example. And the most recent development on it has been in the last week, it passed second stage. The legislation to accompany the regulator passed second stage. And what it now has is, I suppose, ramped up powers. So previously it was only going to be accessing publicly available information, so from, you know, annual reports from companies, agri-food companies, retailers, processors and so on, and, you know, publicly available information, to now it has been given the power by Minister McConlogue to seek and review internal documentation on margin. So again, look, you'd like to think this regulator will come in and say, look at the margin the farmer's making, look at the margin that the packer is making, and then the retailer, and kind of seek a fairness in that supply chain. Farmers are calling for that. That's what they're hoping for. But at the moment, you know, they don't feel viable. You know, they're facing input costs across the board that have gone up. Something as simple as, again, you know, listeners mightn't be aware of, but a pullet is a pint of lay hen, and a pint of lay pullet. And for the average egg producing farmer, they have to replace or replenish their flock with pullets on a regular basis. I think it's a 9-month cycle. And that production cost Now, that input cost has gone up, say, from a pullet costing $4.60 in 2021 to costing as recently as September last year, it was $5.85. It's now currently at $5.93, and farmers are fearful that it's going to push above beyond the €6 mark in February. And you might say that's small money, or listeners might think that's small money, but when you replicate that across, say, seven, you know, multiple thousand birds, you're talking a serious injection of cost into the production system for that farmer. So they really are at their wit's end at the moment. And as you said, look, you know, when you're introducing me there, you know, everyone, they're Irish eggs, they're a quality product. They're used, you know, in many meals throughout the day, be it breakfast, be it in baking and so on. And it would really be a shame to see some of our producers stepping away from their systems.
It absolutely would, especially if the alternative is to go further afield and start importing them from somewhere else, particularly when there's been such a good industry there. Hopefully that will resolve itself and that we don't have to give up the egg in the morning, because I think for a lot of us it would be hard to imagine life without eggs. Hopefully it won't come to that. But Barry, thank you so much for talking to me this evening, and I look forward to hearing more about that story as it progresses.
Thanks for having me, Ronan.
That's Barry Murphy there, a news reporter with the Irish Farmers Journal. So if you're noticing that, actually, as again, this is mainly the margins for farmers is the big issue here, that whilst the price and the shelves may not be going up a huge amount at the minute, the actual margin the farmers can make, because as Barry's pointed out, there's often kind of middlemen or middle companies in there too in terms of packing the eggs and stuff that are possibly taking the profits too. So it's quite interesting though, isn't it, when you look at any kind of supply chain issues and you dig a little bit deeper, there's so many other issues that are kind of happening there too, or there's maybe very intricate relationships that you may not be aware of. So I guess it comes back to that question of provenance. You know, do you know where your eggs are coming from, and how directly or how close to source can you get those? Are you picking them up from your local farmer or a local small-scale producer, and that you know they're coming straight from those hens into a box into you? Or are there numerous companies involved in the middle, and who's actually benefiting at the end of the day? So interesting questions that we can all ponder. Still to come, a recent survey has indicated that quite a large proportion of Irish people feel that they have been subject to some form of discrimination in the workplace at some point of their career. That's based on a survey carried out by Matrix Recruitment. They'll bring you some more on that in about 10 or 15 minutes' time. And also we'll have a little bit of reaction from Laois, because yet another small local business has decided to close its doors. We'll look more at what might be causing that and what the reasons for that were. But first, it's been announced recently that Eurisbeg, an Irish-owned investment firm, has acquired a majority stake in Mullingar-headquartered ORS. ORS is a multidisciplinary building consultancy offering design, planning and management services via a team of highly skilled designers, consulting engineers, planners, scientists and surveyors. It is one of an exclusive number of Engineers Ireland CPD accredited employers in the country, and is also officially recognised as one of the best workplaces in Ireland. Managing Director John Brennan joins me now too. John has been Managing Director of ORS for a number of years now. We'll also hear in this from Andrew Murphy, private equity partner at Eurisbeg. But John, I suppose to begin, could you just remind us of the nature of the professional services that ORS provides?
Hey, good evening, Ronan. Thanks a million for having us. So, ORS is, as you said, a building consultancy, a multidisciplinary building consultancy. We have a team of about 85 people at the moment, spread across, headquartered in Mullingar, but spread across six other locations across the country at the moment. Expanding rapidly, in business for about 30 years, founded originally by Paul O'Reilly of Fimber Stewart. Services-wise, as you'd expect from a business like ours, the more traditional things like civil structural engineering, health and safety, transportation and project management, and then backed up by a number of, complemented by a number of niche areas like the assigned certifier, fire safety, environmental, energy and building surveying. So pretty busy.
Well, it has been like a lot of areas, a lot of sectors, a tough couple of years, particularly in construction as well, with shutdowns, closures. You know, it may have had an impact on some investment in certain projects around the country too. You know, the growth seems to have continued with yourselves, where you've expanded that footprint right across the country. And what has really driven that? What sets ORS apart from other consultancies that are out there?
I mean, we've been lucky. The last 7 or 8 years for us have been, the growth has been fairly consistent, 25-30% every year. And thinking back on it, like, we would have rebranded and restructured in 2015, which did make a difference. But primarily, I remember back then the director started really thinking about what set us apart and as you said, made us different. So the differentiators, because obviously they say that if you can't, you know, compete differently in a market, you won't compete in the long term. So when we started doing that, you know, two things really jumped out at us. First of all, being multidisciplined is vital. I mean, for obvious reasons. I mean, the more services you provide, the more attractive you are on to clients and to larger projects. But also, being multidisciplined can provide a lot of resilience and protection in a downturn. So, you know, some teams will you know, get quiet, some teams will get busy, and you can move teams around. So that's a big advantage. And also, we changed the way we do our strategy, actually, which is just one point to make. I remember at this stage, which is a famous video by Michael Dell at Dell Computers, where he spoke about the importance of, you know, if you're writing 3 to 5 year plans, they're really only aspirational, because the world changes so quickly nowadays. We see wars, we see pandemics. And if you want to grow a business, you need to really focus on short-term goals, really focus on them and action them. So be that weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly. So we do a lot of that, and that's worked very well. But I think the main thing for us, and the thing we've been recognized for a lot lately, or especially over the last couple of years, is the focus we have on our culture.
So within an engineering organization or a building consultancy, effectively, when you speak of things like culture, what had you been doing? Like, or it wasn't just the pandemic, obviously, that made you look at things like remote working or staff welfare. Had you been at that beforehand? And what are the kind of key things that you do with ORS?
I often get asked, again, because we've been recognized for it, I get asked regularly, like, what is it, or how I define culture? You know, it's an intangible thing, but it's the feel of the business. And to simplify it a little bit, I always describe it as, it's how you feel about a business on a Sunday night before you know you have to go to work on the Monday morning. So if that feeling is good, you know that the culture is on point. So we knew, you know, when the company was founded originally, you know, the culture was good and strong, and it has remained that way. And we decided that we wanted to try and formalize that, publicize it and market it a bit more and make it more attractive to prospective employees coming in. So like we did lots of things, but you touched on it there. Hybrid work is the main one for us, and it's been a complete game changer. So we were doing that for a good few years before COVID, where we moved to what essentially is an ultra flexible model. So again, just to simplify it a bit, I mean, our teams wake up in the morning and they decide where they work. So be that in a hub or our HQ, or whether it's at home, and that depends on their personality, depends on the work they have to do that day. And it suits them. So with that, there's obviously a huge amount of trust. And hand in hand with that comes a really strong focus on measurable. So we resisted bringing people back for 1 day, 2 days. And that approach has really worked well for us and, you know, keeps the culture strong. There's lots of other things, but that's the main one. And I think, you know, culture, if the culture is working, your staff turnover should be relatively low, and it should, you know, represent itself in a more consistent delivery for your clients and customers. Yes.
How is that model received by your clients? Because the construction sector would be typically one that's associated with kind of, you know, 8 to 5 in the days, you know, very much on sites in a physical location. Mm-hmm. How did your customers react when you first started exploring the idea of remote working?
Quite well. I mean, we're a consultancy at the end of the day. So, I mean, we're not contractors. So, you know, a lot of clients, as I said, it represents itself in a more consistent delivery from our people. You know, people are more content, they're happier at work. We have very low staff turnover, so that inevitably keeps your clients happy. You know, so yeah, it's worked very well,
and has been a crucial element in retaining those staff as well. Particularly, which you've been more Midlands based, to issues around recruiting and actually finding staff in the first instance. Again, does having that culture make that easier? Or is it actually a challenge? Because we know there's a huge amount of shortages and vacancies within that sector too.
There is, but again, like we're a nationwide firm now. I mean, we're headquartered in Mullingar. It's very important to us, but we have an office in Dublin. We have an office in, soon to open office in Cork. We have one in Sligo, Letterkenny, Dublin. And we essentially go, because of that model, we essentially go where the teams are from. So for example, with fire safety, we have you know, a lot of fire engineers based in 2 offices in Letterkenny and Donegal. So again, that model of hybrid working enables us to do that. Now, I'm probably simplifying it a little bit. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes on in the background. We have a girl called Rachel Murray, who's our head of employee engagement, who works really hard to make sure that we bring teams together and deal with the issues that arise from remote working, which are well publicized at this point, like, for example, work-life balance and coping with workload and things like that.
What then prompted ORS to begin looking at funding and explore the various avenues that were out there?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think sometimes with investment stories, they can be a little bit overcomplicated. Ours was a really straightforward story. In 2019, we completed a management buyout, an MBO, with one of our founders, Carl O'Reilly. And that was, you know, relatively straightforward. And our other founder, Finbar Stewart, was always planning to retire in 23, 24. So when we went to look at options last year of how to facilitate that, it became clear very quickly that an MBO was not going to be as straightforward as it was previously, for a number of reasons. So when we started looking at the options that were there. Private equity really appealed to me because there were for a couple of reasons. First of all, it enabled you to continue on the journey that you were on, growing ORS, you know, keeping that focus on the culture that I talked about this evening. I mean, just one example, after we signed the deal on the 22nd of December, I think it was, and Christmas holidays came and we went back into the office and myself and the director spoke to everybody individually to explain what the investment was about. So to be able to talk to your team, everybody, and say it's business as usual, we're going to grow faster. It's a good news story, but everything remains the same. Our process, policies, our hybrid work, that there's a real advantage to that. You know, so that was one reason. The other reason, which probably doesn't get stated enough, is that when you meet funds like Eris Begg and you meet people like Andrew and Thomas Davy, these are people who have extensive experience in helping firms like ours that might have reached an inflection point to go to the next level. So that, you know, that wisdom, that experience was something that was very attractive to us. So for they were the two main reasons that we went with private equity and were delighted to be on board.
It's probably quite unique, or it's not that common within, again, the construction and consultancy services, but it is something that we see happening. Again, a number of Midlands companies over the past year or two have sold a majority shareholding or a stake to a private equity company. But to find out more about private equity, we're delighted to be joined by Andrew Murphy. And Andrew is a private equity partner at Eris Begg. Good evening to you, Andrew. I suppose, begin, just give us an outline of who Eris Begg are and kind of what you do and what areas you typically look at investing in.
Sure, Ronan. Pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me on. Eris Begg, at the moment, we're a 110 million fund. Originally, it was founded in 2017 by my colleagues Thomas Davy and Alan Carr. Thomas was ex-DCC and wanted to do something new. And Alan had founded a company called Harbour Master, sold to Blackstone, ran Blackstone GSO for EMEA for a number of years, and as well wanted to do something different. So they knew each other a long time. They bought the first business as a holding company through Eris Begg Holdings. It was BP Multipage. And then in 2018, my other colleague as a partner, Robert Burns, got involved and helped the guys complete food safety company acquisition. I got to know the guys during 2018 as well, as I was looking at my own acquisition at the same time that Thomas was looking at it. And then we sort of started looking at a number of things together. And I guess in 2019, start of 2019, we formalized everything and came on board as a quartet effectively. And in 19, we completed the investment into Midray Imaging Systems in December. That was followed very quickly with a UK acquisition of their main supplier, Carestream's UK business, where I guess, you know, the operational experience that we have across the Eris Begg team sort of really helped and sort of bed down all we were getting were contracts and staff, and we had to build a business around that and support the Medray management. And since then, with that performance, we got, you know, some interest from European institutional investors, more than likely on the back of Alan's experience in the financial world. From that, we were able to close our fundraising for an actual fund. And of that, there two European institutional investors, and we were also joined by AIB as a local LP into the fund at the end of August 2022. So what we do is we look to take majority stakes in well-run businesses with strong management. Sometimes that involves some of the existing management or shareholders who want to sort of take some money or to sort of move on and maybe leave the business, but leave it in good shape. There's already successor management in place. And for us then, you know, the key criteria we look for are, it's really all about the management and backing management. We have effectively five platforms. And from there, we back sort of key management to drive growth in those platforms, both organically and through acquisition. But ultimately, as John says, the sort of the management that are in place are in the driving seat. We're there to nudge, challenge and support, provide capital where required if there's a compelling either internal investment in an internal project or an acquisition of a complementary business, or indeed, you know, an expansion into a new market that requires capital to prepare for it.
How did a company like ORS first come onto your horizon?
So it's interesting that the advisor that ORS engaged with to assess options was an advisor we'd worked with on a number of transactions previously. Indeed, they would have advised in the Medray transaction, for example. I suppose, you know, with good operators across the market, they'll see who's a good fit. There isn't that many PE firms, for example, operating in Ireland. It's a growing number, but I guess any corporate finance advisor in the market will get a sense of who's who and whether it is a good chemistry or cultural fit. Ultimately, that's the call of the company they're advising, but they'll generally know who's a good match. And I guess Alan Kelly in Focus Capital gave me a call and asked would I be interested in just meeting John and Fimber. We did. Yeah, I was kind of blown away really with the quality of the business from the initial meeting, asked to find out more, and ultimately we developed a relationship that I think there was a lot of trust developed between the parties, and it meant that we managed to agree a deal that everybody seemed to be very happy with. We're very happy with it. I think the ambition that's within the business is really what it's all about, and our job is to really help, you know, unlock that ambition and support John and his management team in executing a real strong growth strategy.
I know John mentioned earlier that that famous Michael Dell quote about sometimes looking 5 years ahead can be aspirational, but obviously at Aerospeg you see something in ORS. Typically, you know, are you in these kind of deals for the long haul, or do you actually map out a potential exit plan down the, you know, at some point?
Well, I guess, you know, one thing to say is our first investment was in 2017 and we haven't sold a business yet. So our fund is relatively young in that our first close was in 2021. So we're under no pressure to move any assets on in the near term. I would say, you know, the nature of things is there may be some time at some stage in the future, but we don't necessarily start with looking for the exit door, you know. So it can be a sort of a bit of an issue if that is the focus. You can end up sort of cutting yourself off from opportunities.
John, so if we break this back down to what it actually means for ORS, I know there's kind of predictions that it could help you create a further 150 roles across the country in the coming years as well. I mean, that's significant.
What it means for us is, as you said, it's been strategized at the moment, so it's quite high level. But we, just looking at initial figures, we estimate anywhere between 120 and 150 new positions across the firm. So that's across the existing 9 service lines and then whatever additional service lines that we open up. So with that, I talked earlier about, you know, following the workers. So it would be following the team. So you will see a number of ORS hubs opening up, I would assume, in more remote locations and then more kind of larger space in some of the larger towns and cities. We also have a strategy ready to go into the UK, which we worked on with Enterprise Ireland over the last year. We just haven't pushed the button on that yet. So more than likely, we'll see that materialize towards maybe the second half of the year. So I touched on earlier, I mean, there are a number of different services that we don't offer at the moment that we would like to offer. And we need to look at that and decide whether we grow that organically or through acquisition. And we'll be doing that over the next couple of weeks. But I mean, there's been already in the last week since the announcement went out, we've had a couple of smaller businesses approach us about sitting down and having a chat. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's exciting times ahead, Ronan.
As you begin to settle in these new arrangements too, and, you know, and we look at expanding the business, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of job opportunities coming up for people. If there are, what's the best way for people maybe that are listening to get in touch with ORS and see what might be available?
Yes, so we have, Ron, I think about 15 open roles at the moment across various disciplines right across the country. So we're actively recruiting now. So if anybody listening is interested, you can head to ors.ie and onto our careers page there. So you'll see all our open roles. Obviously, that the number of jobs should grow considerably over the next few months and few years. We also are active in the local and national press in around where our various offices are, and we're also very active on LinkedIn. So if you follow all three of those, you'll see our various open positions.
John Brennan, Managing Director of ORS, and Andrew Murphy, Private Equity Partner at Aerisbeg. Thank you so much for that. Aerisbeg, of course, have taken a majority stake in Mullingar headquartered ORS. Another great success story for the Midlands and many more great things to come. Matrix Recruitment is a leading regional recruitment firm and with national leverage. It was established in 1998 and currently has offices in Waterford, Carlow and in Athlone. In November last year, they carried out their fifth Matrix Workplace Equality Survey. It was conducted online and it surveyed 2,741 adults working across a broad range of industries, sectors and regions. It has thrown up some quite interesting results, in particular that it suggests that 3 in 4 workers in the country have experienced workplace discrimination at some stage. To dig a little bit deeper, I'm delighted to be joined by Breda Dooley from Matrix Recruitment. Breda, quite an interesting survey. Can you tell us more about, I suppose, why you looked at discrimination in the first instance and then take us through some of the key findings?
Yes, as you mentioned, this is Matrix fifth year in looking at this survey, and I suppose discrimination, it's something that was very much highlighted out of this survey. It's an increase of 54% on last year's survey, where 3 out of 4 people have experienced some form of discrimination. And I suppose when I say, experienced, they might have witnessed this, or, they might have perceived to have seen discrimination. They mightn't have experienced it directly themselves. And, you'd look at maybe people, are they a lot more educated around discrimination? What are the areas for discrimination as well? We're seeing a lot more on social media, on adverts. There's a lot more talked about it. It's, and people are a lot more knowledgeable about discrimination, and that's maybe the reason as to why it's quite highlighted in this survey.
Absolutely. I suppose if that information is out there and people might reflect even on past situations and realise that actually maybe what they were witnessing wasn't just the way things were, it was an element of discrimination. It of course, though, is quite a wide-ranging term as well. So you did focus on kind of particular types of discrimination. Can you take us through some of those?
Yes, I suppose racism came up as 73% of the workers surveyed believed Ireland has an issue with workplace discrimination, and it's a very high percentage to have. We're living in a very multicultural environment, country now. Ireland is a lot different to where it was 10 years ago. Like if you even just look back there before Christmas, we had over 3,500 people. From different 130 different countries received their Irish citizenship. So Ireland has changed. And in that, we're bringing in a lot, different cultures into the workplace. And maybe this is why I suppose racism is there. It's something that, it shouldn't be in the place. While the respondents might have experienced racism, they might have witnessed it. We're all aware, or maybe have seen or even heard of, the coffee shop attendants getting racially abused, or you're hearing the stories on the news about bus drivers and taxi drivers experiencing some sort of racism. And it's something, it shouldn't be tolerated in the workplace. One good thing that came out of the survey when asked the respondents about racism is that employers are putting in a lot of measures in place to try and wipe out discrimination. They're putting a lot of training around it and making people aware of what racism and discrimination is.
And of course, it's also showing up there that people, they do see it as being a potential blocker to somebody of a different ethnicity trying to maybe progress up the career ladder as well. Mm. But again, good to know that it is being addressed as well, or at least attempts are being made to address it in the workplace. You also looked at things like ethnic and sexual discrimination and found that actually sexual discrimination is still very prevalent in the Irish workplace.
Yeah, it's something that is not going away. It was highlighted again that there is 29 people have surveyed that they've experienced some sort of sexual harassment. And, again, it comes back to education around companies having really good policies around it. Like a little, rub on the shoulder, a pat on the hand, or, a message going out after work, from a boss or another, work colleague, if there's any kind of sexual around it, it needs to be addressed. But employers need to educate their workforce as to what sexual harassment is. And again, something that shouldn't be tolerated either.
And quite interestingly, when we talk about like gender and sexual harassment as well, it also kind of leads to that area of the glass ceiling and indeed gender quotas and the gender pay gap. And quite staggeringly, almost everyone who took part in the survey, 92% of respondents felt that there's a glass ceiling for women in the workplace. So like a lot has been done in the last 10 years to try to change that. Why do you think it still exists?
I suppose it's probably the survey would kind of say that, you know, we're seeing 92% of people have feel that there is a glass ceiling. It probably comes back down to, and you're probably seeing the adverts even recently, I've seen in the last, that women are still seen as the carers, you know, the home carers, and maybe they're not given the same opportunity as their male colleague. Like we are seeing the likes of maybe the bigger international companies and the public sector bringing in gender quota balances. And that is brilliant to see. And in fairness, Ireland is doing quite well, you know, across Europe in terms of trying to meet their gender quotas. I suppose what I'd be saying to people, you have to hire the right person for the right job. So just to meet your gender quota balance, you still need to make sure that you have the right skill set in place. And research has shown that if you have a man and a woman working at a kind of a senior level, that, you know, it has a positive impact on the company, you know, both culturally, both financially, both production increases. So it is shown. So we need to, I suppose, continue to work. It can be hard, you know, for a smaller, you know, medium-sized company to try and to meet that gender quota balance and to get that skill set. So what I'd be saying to them is that, you know, if you are and you want to meet it, get the experts to help you, like work with a recruitment agency or, you know, the likes of us, Matrix Recruitment. They can help you recruit the right person, you know, and get the right skill set as well.
And get that again, blend and bit of diversity into your management team or whatever part of your business too. But quite interesting, the survey also looks at things like workplace bullying, and maybe this is a direct offshoot from all the working from home and Zoom and Teams meeting, but actually workplace bullying is still very prevalent, and indeed virtual or online bullying is something that people are recording and reporting in your survey.
Yeah, and it's right. You're saying the hybrid and the remote working has probably brought this online bullying to highlight it a little bit more. You know, people are experiencing it either through kind of online videos or, you know, group WhatsApp group set up work or emails. And, you know, you could be at the end of the day and somebody sends you an email and you're having a tough day and it's in block capital letters, you know. And if you're in the office, you know, you could have a conversation, but whereas if you send it like that, people can interpret it so many ways, you know. So, you know, I suppose, again, it comes back to that employers, again, would need to make sure that they're, you know, they have, I suppose, correct policies and procedures in place around bullying and, you know, what constitutes kind of online bullying as well. You know, you must be, you know, it's up to an employer to make sure that their employee feels happy and safe coming into the work environment.
And like all those things you've touched on, really, it's raising awareness, looking at your own policies and procedures and making sure that, because it in turn is going to make your company more attractive for when you go recruiting as well, because undoubtedly a challenging market out there. But Breida, sorry, time is just running out on us now at the minute, but thank you so much for giving us that comprehensive overview of the survey that was carried out by Matrix Recruitment, and all the best, and we'll talk to you again in the future.
Thank you very much, Ronan.
That's Breida Dooley there from Matrix Recruitment, and speaking about the fifth Matrix Workplace Equality Survey that was carried out last year in November by an online survey, and the results are there, quite interesting. Check out matrixrecruitment.com for a copy of that or more, and to read more about that. The looming closure of Argos all across the country was widely publicised last week, but if we turn a spotlight onto County Laois, just today, or at the weekend actually, it was announced that the Sweet Bakery on James Fintan Lawler Avenue had closed its doors last weekend due to rising operating costs, but it follows in the line of other Port Laois businesses, including Rafters Cafe and the Butcher's Block in Laois Shopping Centre, that have closed their doors recently. Carolyn Hoffman, the CEO of Laois Chamber Alliance, joins me now. Carolyn, any indication what is driving these companies out of business?
Well, Ronan, it's sad to see another closure here in Laois. It's not an issue unique to the county. It's happening nationally. Certain sectors and businesses appear to be more exposed than others. Sweet Bakery, for example, they cited in their announcement on Saturday that it was a combination of raw material costs, operational costs, transport, petrol, and all that adds up. And it's really unfortunate to see that happen. They've been there 4 years. They had a great presence in Port Leash. The footfall is there. Perhaps people's consumer habits have changed, but it's something I've mentioned, you know, the past couple of months. Support such as the Temporary Business Energy Support Scheme just don't go far enough, and they're due to expire at the end of February. So I'd really hope that government would be in a position to extend this. We had a very positive surplus for Budget 2023, and government needs to step up. They did it during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they need to do it again, or we're going to see far more closures now.
Do you think exactly that? Do you think more businesses are going to follow suit?
Unfortunately, I think it's the start of it. As I said, some sectors are more exposed than others, particularly hospitality. The margins are so tight. Businesses are trying to absorb as much as they can. But with tight margins like that, if a business isn't sustainable, you just can't keep operating. What I would say to people, though, is engage with your local enterprise office, your business support unit in your local authority, or if you're a Leash business who's finding things particularly difficult at the moment, do reach out to myself in the chamber, and we'll see what's available to you and how we can help. There are options out there. And Revenue, for example, they extended the debt warehousing scheme until May 2024, so there are options there for anyone who's finding things particularly difficult at the moment, as everyone is. We're all feeling it in our pockets as well, unfortunately.
That's it. I suppose I started off the show looking at the price of eggs and potential price rises and increases that are looming there too, all of which are going to affect those very companies, particularly bakeries and those smaller shops too. Hopefully things can change, something can be done as well. But for anybody listening, maybe that's not even a member of the chamber too, they're welcome to get in touch with you and see if, because you said there's a myriad of supports out there. It can be quite confusing, quite ambiguous, but you're there to help.
Absolutely. Look, contact me. We're on leashchamber.ie. Pick up the phone, drop into our office, and we're more than happy to help. And I really hope that, you know, government will step up and provide the supports that businesses really need at the moment.
No bother. Caroline, thank you so much as well. Important message to get out there and continue up the great work there in Leash too. And that's it. If you are a business that is feeling the pinch and maybe you're at that breaking point where you're not sure where to go next as well, the advice from most people is just reach out. Reach out to somebody else in a similar business. Reach out to your local enterprise office, whatever other local supports are there, and see what can be done. Speak to your accountant. See if there's ways of restructuring and see how things might be changed. Because the one thing we can absolutely assure is you're not alone. You're not the only business that is experiencing those challenges too. Anyway, hopefully that is of help to you and you can continue to trade and keep the business and keep our town centres and our villages and our communities vibrant and open and keep giving that great service that we've given and you've given over all the years. Time for me now to give way and make way for Mr. Joe Cooney. He'll be here after 8 o'clock with Country Roads. Will Faulkner on Midlands Today for the rest of the week. We'll be looking at those key issues around the areas from 9 to 12 every day, particularly rising costs, the cost of living, business costs. Always tune in to Will, always right at the forefront of what's happening in your area. So time for me to vacate the seat. It's been a pleasure as always. Hopefully this evening's content has brought you some good news and has brought you some insights into how businesses are working and what can be done to grow businesses or sustain businesses. It's been a pleasure. I have to go now. I will talk to you next Tuesday from 7 p.m. Stay safe, keep up the great work, and talk to you all soon.
Taking Care of Business returns next Tuesday at 7 p.m. with the local enterprise offices of Leash, Offaly and Westmeath. Find us on localenterprise.ie and let's talk business.